Welcome, everybody, to our MedCast podcast on enfortumab vedotin and the evolving landscape of bladder cancer care. This is going to be the pharmacist's guide to ADCs, combination therapy, and expanding clinical engagement. And my name is Emma Jones. I'm a clinical GU specialist and oncology pharmacy supervisor at Huntsman Cancer Institute. That's in Salt Lake City, Utah. And I am delighted to be joined here by my peer, Kristen, if she'll introduce herself, and then we'll get going into the content.
Yeah, so my name is Kristen Nimberg. I am one of the GU medical oncology specialists at the James Cancer Hospital located in Columbus, Ohio. So I'm excited to join Emma today to kind of talk about bladder cancer, specifically enfortumab and pembrolizumab.
Thanks, Kristen. All right, so I think to set the stage of this topic, right, it's nice to just kind of understand the bladder cancer treatment landscape. And historically we've used a lot of different therapies, and it's really evolved over the last 3 to 5 years. So if you could just reflect on maybe where we were and where we are now, and how that maybe impacts the volume and complexity of the patients that we're seeing as clinical pharmacists.
Yeah, so I feel like when I started my job back in 2020, cisplatin or platinum-based chemo plus gemcitabine was kind of the name of the game, whether it was in the metastatic setting, the muscle-invasive setting. And I feel like now that's kind of been completely flipped on its head. So fast forward to like December 2023, we had the FDA approval of enfortumab and pembrolizumab in the metastatic setting, first line. And then, 2 years later, we have now the approval of the pembrolizumab and enfortumab combination in the muscle invasive cisplatin ineligible setting. And as of, April 2026, so like last week, the FDA did kind of make an announcement that they were going to grant priority review to enfortumab pembrolizumab in our cisplatin eligible muscle invasive bladder cancer patients. So I feel like, in the past, chemo was the name of the game, but now I feel like we are just seeing an explosion of pembrolizumab and enfortumab, both in the metastatic and the muscle invasive setting. So, bladder cancer treatment has really changed over the past 5 years.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. It has changed just in, the short time that we've both been in practice, which just really goes to show how quickly oncology is moving. And we've even got expanded, treatments beyond enfortumab and pembrolizumab, right? We've got some other targeted agents against FGFR3 and HER2, and all these things are coming out. And it's just a really exciting time to be practicing in the GU space. So hopefully everybody can sense that from us today. I think another thing that's kind of changed is historically we really used to be thinking about bladder cancer patients and their eligibility for treatment, right? Because we were giving such toxic medications with cisplatin-based chemotherapies in the past. With the new therapies, do you feel like this issue of treatment eligibility has improved or changed in any way? Or how would you describe where we're at now?
I feel like in terms of treatment eligibility, like you said, I think before it used to revolve around, are these patients cisplatin candidates, especially in the muscle invasive setting? If not, kind of our job in medical oncology was easy because we could send them back to urology for their surgery. But I feel like now what we're seeing is we are able to treat more patients with these new indications. And so, in clinic specifically, I feel like we are now treating more medically complex patients, which is now involving the pharmacist more. So, we're treating a patient with more comorbidities, say type 2 diabetes. And, we know enfortumab carries the risk for hyperglycemia. So, how do we as pharmacists manage blood glucose control in the setting of giving, a therapy that could potentially cause an elevation in that? Or if they have, peripheral neuropathy from their uncontrolled type 2 diabetes and they're already on gabapentin and we're starting enfortumab, which can cause neuropathy. So I feel like in terms of eligibility, we have more patients who can get treated, but we also now have more medically complex patients, which I think makes our job more di it's more difficult, but I feel like now we're really able to kind of finesse the expertise of the oncology pharmacist in treating these patients who we previously couldn't treat before.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Most of the providers out there are saying that, Maybe 5% of patients would not be eligible for enfortumab pembrolizumab, which is just completely different than what we used to think about, right? Where 50 to 60% of patients were not cisplatin eligible. And then you've got even, another 30% that aren't platinum eligible. So I
Right.
totally agree. We've really opened the door to be able to treat these patients with these alternative therapies that have been shown to be extremely effective. And when you think about like a typical patient with bladder cancer, oftentimes they are medically complex. They're older, average age of diagnosis is 73. They've got comorbidities. And so I do think that we as pharmacists can add a lot of value to the team now with all these unique side effects and supportive care regimens that we're implementing for these patients.
Yeah, I feel like any patient that now comes through on PEMBRAVI, they're like, all right, Kristen, like let's look at their med list and see what we can optimize and what are your concerns. So no, we're definitely at the forefront of getting kind of involved in these patients' care, which is exciting.
Yeah. And so, we've been talking a little bit about the general indications for enfortumab pembrolizumab for these patients, but how, or can you tell me a little bit about the data that is behind this and kind of a broad strokes, pivotal trials that really are something that pharmacists should be familiar with?
Yeah, so I feel like the three trials that kind of come to mind for this are the EV-302, EV-303, and EV-304. So to kind of set the stage for each of them, we have the EV-302 trial, which really led to the FDA approval of pembrolizumab and enfortumab in our metastatic setting, specifically in the first-line metastatic setting, which showed kind of improved overall survival with pembrolizumab and enfortumab. Compared to platinum-based chemo. So that kind of flipped the metastatic treatment kind of algorithm on its head. And then we fast forward to the EV-303 trial, which compared, perioperative, so before cystectomy and after cystectomy, enfortumab and pembrolizumab compared to cystectomy alone. And basically, what that trial did find was improved event-free survival, overall survival. And now they're kind of looking at this pathologic complete response rate as well. And we're seeing kind of improvement in all of that with pembrolizumab and enfortumab. And that was specifically in those patients who are muscle invasive cisplatin ineligible. The data that kind of people are really excited about now is we have the EV-304 data coming out that's basically showing an improvement in those same outcomes. So event-free survival, overall survival, and pathologic complete response rate with enfortumab and pembrolizumab in the muscle-invasive cisplatin-eligible setting compared to traditional cisplatin-based chemo. So I think that once we have that kind of FDA approval come through, we basically now have enfortumab and pembrolizumab as the first frontline regimen, both in the muscle-invasive setting and in the metastatic setting, which is really exciting.
That was a great summary, and I think it's really important just to kind of reflect on when, EV-302 data came out, and there was standing ovation at all of
Yeah.
these conferences, right? Like the
Right.
whole world was flipped on its head, just like you said. Everybody was shocked at these response rates and these overall survival metrics that were double that of our standard chemotherapy, right? That's pretty unheard of when you think about just oncology as a whole. There's not a lot of therapies that are blowing out our traditional standard of care of the water as much as this. So, thanks for that summary. That was really awesome. And then we've kind of touched on this already, but what are maybe some of the main changes in the pharmacist role where we're using, non-cytotoxic chemotherapies and we're shifting to some of these newer therapies with unique side effects?
I think, like I said before, kind of we're basically now involved in every step of implementing the pembrolizumab and enfortumab treatment plan. I think the area that I find myself being heavily involved in right now is, side effect management. So when we think of enfortumab, we're thinking of like the rash and itchy skin that can present itself. In terms of side effects as well, do we need to hold treatment versus do we need to dose reduce? So I feel like I've been really helpful in helping my teams kind of navigate what treatment-related side effect is worth a dose reduction and like we can push through versus what do we truly need to hold. And then another area where I feel feel like I've kind of helped evolve practice is just the supportive care, just because it is different than what we used to prescribe with cisplatin and gemcitabine. I feel like with that regimen, we're so focused on, nausea and vomiting and things like that. Whereas with this one, we kind of have some different supportive care. So, artificial tears for the dry eye, or, creams and emollients for the dry skin. So I feel like just kind of finessing the different supportive care is kind of another area where I've kind of been able to evolve my role with our teams when it comes to pembrolizumab and infortimab. I feel like we've had the chance to kind of set the stage for the historical perspective of bladder cancer, kind of how pembrolizumab and infortimab became kind of our frontline regimen, both in the muscle invasive setting and the metastatic setting. But I feel like, as pharmacists, we'd be remiss to not talk about mechanism of action, how the drug works, how it's dosed, and things like that. So, Emma, I guess my first question for you is, if you were to explain the mechanism of action to a pharmacist who's not as comfortable with antibody drug conjugates, how would you explain how infortimab works?
Yeah, I love this question because this is just the detail that pharmacists are interested in, right? And they work very differently than our traditional cytotoxic chemotherapies. So antibody drug conjugates are not necessarily a new concept, right? We think back to all of our training in the heme world where brentuximab has been out for many, many years, but it is new a lot for a lot of our oncology or solid tumor spaces. And so enfortumab vedotin is an antibody drug conjugate, meaning it's a antibody that is attached to a linked cytotoxic payload, and it targets a specific receptor that is typically usually expressed preferentially on cancer cells instead of healthy cells. So that's kind of the general overview of what an ADC is. Specifically for enfortumab vedotin, we see that this was designed to target Nectin-4, which is a transmembrane receptor. It's involved in like adhesion and proliferation of tumor cells, and it's expressed very highly on bladder cancer cells and other solid tumors as well. So sneak peek, maybe we'll see this, being used in other cancers in the future too, like breast and lung and ovarian cancers. But we know that it's expressed at high levels. Therefore, we have this targeted kill with enfortumab vedotin. And it's minimally expressed, like I said, on healthy tissue, typically in epithelial cells. So that does lead to some of our side effects that we're going to talk about today. And then once the antibody drug conjugate binds to the receptor on the cancer cell, it's internalized, and then its cytotoxic payload is cleaved. And that's where that mechanism really comes from. And for enfortumab vedotin, it's attached to MMAE or monomethyl auristatin E, which is a tubulin inhibitor. That disrupts microtubules, very similar to our taxane chemotherapies. And again, this is why we see the side effects that we do, like the pretty extensive high rates of neuropathy. So that's kind of the general concept. There's, a lot of nuance to these where they're trying to really maximize the bystander effect and the targeted aspect and minimize the adverse effects in order to avoid some of those on target or off tumor side effects. But there's new ones coming out every day. And I think this is just one of the most fascinating mechanisms that we have in the oncology space at this time.
Yeah, no, I feel like it's crazy the number of antibody drug conjugates that are just coming to market. There are different indications and things like that. So to kind of piggyback off of that, are there any other antibody drug conjugates that we will see in the bladder cancer space?
Yeah, so in addition to enfortumab vedotin, we also have sacituzumab govitecan. So some of you, if you've been practicing as long as we have, will recognize this as something that we were pretty excited about originally, and then the FDA approval was removed based on the data being finalized. And so as a subsequent line option, but this one is targeting TROP2, which is again another GES receptor that's expressed on bladder cancer cells. And interestingly, the payload is SN38, which maybe you guys recognize that as the active drug of irinotecan, the topoisomerase 1 inhibitor. So with that, we see different side effects based on both the target and that payload, where we see a lot of diarrhea. And then we also have Enhertu, which is, as many of you are probably aware, approved by the FDA for that tumor-agnostic HER2-positive solid tumors. And so that's another option for our bladder cancer patients who do express HER2 in the subsequent line. That's really where they're pushing for more of these biomarker-targeted therapies. This one, again, is targeting HER2, and then it has that topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payload as well. So again, seeing a different side effect profile here, more ILD, but we also see that with enfortumab. So it is quite fascinating just to see how the different design of the antibody drug conjugate can affect both the side effects and what we're seeing in our patients.
Yeah, no, and I feel like you said too, with the payload of the drug, I always like to draw the comparison to like what other drug class does it kind of look like? So, with the enfortumab and the taxanes, the topoisomerase 1 inhibitor with the irinotecan, and that really helps me to kind of frame my reference for like what side effects, even if we don't use these drugs every day, do we kind of expect to see with them? So I feel like that's super helpful. My last kind of question for you related to antibody drug conjugates and enfortumab specifically is, are there kind of any areas or misconceptions that you think pharmacists kind of, or pitfalls perhaps, that pharmacists misunderstand about EV, whether it's kind of about how it's dosed, the cycle structure, or anything that you think is worth clarifying for people?
Yeah, I do think that the dosing is a little bit odd, right? From just comparisons to our cytotoxic chemotherapies, we don't have a lot of therapies that we have a dose cap on. But with our antibody drug conjugates, that's a little bit more common. So with enfortumab, vedotin, we do see a weight-based dosing, again, based on kilograms, which is a little bit different, right? Where a lot of times we're thinking of BSA-based dosing. And they do cap the dose at 100 kilograms. So we start out at 1.25 mgs per kilogram with a max dose of 125, and even with the dose reduction, which I think is another concept that is new to a lot of us, is that we would cap those dose reductions as well from the 100 kilogram standpoint. So if you're at 1 mg per kg, you cap at 100, or 0.75 mgs per kg, you cap at 75. So I think there is some interesting kind of dosing or dose rounding rules that maybe you see at your institution as well.
Yeah, no, I completely agree.
Another kind of interesting thing about antibody drug conjugates that maybe we don't think about as often with like other monoclonal antibodies is drug interactions. And so with enfortumab vedotin, we know that there can be the potential for drug interactions with P-glycoprotein and CYP3A4 because of that cytotoxic payload. So again, I think like thinking more granularly about that mechanism and what's going to interact with that MMAE or the whatever payload it may be is something that we don't necessarily always think about with, say, pembrolizumab, right? Because we're like, we don't have to worry about the metabolism. It's too big of a molecule and it's not going to interact. So I think there's some uniqueness with those as well.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I feel like with pembro, you're really just scanning their med list. Are they on immunosuppressive therapy or, a prednisone dose greater than 10 milligrams? And then you're kind of moving along. Whereas with enfortumab, you do kind of need to be a little bit more cautious as you scan their med list.
Absolutely. Okay, so I think my last question then is, you've said that for the most part we're treating the majority of patients. It's pretty rare when somebody is not eligible for enfortumab and pembrolizumab in either setting. But when we do have these patients who are maybe elderly, like you spoke on, how do you have those conversations with your providers with kind of that fine balance of being part of this collaborative team, but knowing that they make the ultimate decision?
Yeah, no, I feel like this has come with experience too. I feel like the longer I'm kind of in my position, the more comfortable I am with these conversations. I will say, I feel like for nearly every provider, especially if you approach it from like a patient safety perspective, they're very willing to listen to kind of what I have to say. And I feel like not only bringing up maybe my potential concerns, like, hey, I think we need to consider this, dose reduction because of XYZ toxicity, but then also kind of perhaps mentioning additional supportive care or other things that we can do to help the patient. Because I feel like when you're kind of able to bundle it in a nice package, like this is the problem, this is what I kind of think we could do, either an empiric dose reduction or perhaps prescribing this supportive care, it kind of gives the provider guidance on, where your headspace is at, and what you're thinking. But really, I think if you approach something from a patient safety perspective, most providers seem to be really willing to kind of help out. Or not help out, but listen to your concerns and kind of make the appropriate changes. And I feel like the patient safety thing kind of ties in now to the next chapter that we were going to discuss about, which is like adverse effect management, because I know that this is something that I'm definitely very involved in our clinic space. So I think when we think of enfortumab, we think of, rash, itchy skin, peripheral neuropathy, the ocular toxicities, even we can see some myelosuppression with this as well. So I guess, Emma, in your experience, kind of what are the adverse effects where you're seeing leading to, dose modifications, treatment delays, or even kind of discontinuation of drug?
Yeah, I agree, Kristen. You've hit on a lot of the common things that we do see, and we're an active participant in managing. So I think for the most part, I see dose reductions or delays because of peripheral neuropathy, where we are seeing upwards of 50 to 60% of our patients having neuropathy of some sort, whether that's mild is most the case, grade one, grade two. But we see this, anecdotally, I've seen in my practice. Practice around cycle five, which is close to the literature out there around median time to onset of around 5 months, and that's really when my patients are saying this is affecting my ADLs, right? I can't button my shirt. I'm having trouble walking. I feel unstable. I already have diabetes, right? And we're definitely not hesitating to reduce the dose or give them a little bit of a week or two delay to see if that can improve to grade one. But that's going to be probably the most common side effect we see. But I also see plenty of rash. Again, that's very common, 60 to 70%. Again, mostly mild, but I do, I remember when we were first using enfortumab, even on clinical trials here at Huntsman, that I had a patient who had a pretty terrible skin reaction with like desquamation. And we were like, oh my goodness, I think this is it. This is SJS and this needs an immediate referral. And we were so, naive to this treatment because it was so new, but it definitely can happen. And it's something that we all need to be extremely aware of, and it's a huge counseling point for our patients too, from the pharmacist's perspective. Ocular toxicities and hyperglycemia, I don't see as much, and I think that they're manageable without dose reduction or dose delay or discontinuation. But certainly, they should not be forgotten because a lot of our patients do have diabetes as well, or already wear glasses or have dry eyes because they're a bit older. So definitely, all of those are kind of our top toxicities that we focus in on for education and supportive care.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I feel like, and the hard thing too is I think, these patients, we are advertising, not advertising, but it is, hey, this is, not like traditional chemo, but we are still seeing kind of very serious side effects with this as well. So I think letting patients know, yeah, this isn't traditional chemotherapy, but laying this, scene for them that, these are the side effects that we could potentially see with treatment as well, just so they don't think that they're getting, an easy drug that's a walk in the park. So, I feel like that's definitely very important. In regards to, I know you mentioned, dose reducing and you're seeing a lot of peripheral neuropathy. When you're counseling patients, how do you kind of counsel patients to, self-monitor for peripheral neuropathy? And when do you think it requires, team involvement or for them to call into clinic on like an off-cycle day?
Yeah, that comes up all the time, right? And I think, just like you said, setting the expectation up front with the patients is part of our job as advocates and educators, to make sure that they understand what is potentially, in their future. And I usually counsel patients that they'll have some maybe numbness or tingling in their fingers and their toes. It may be painful, like pins and needles, but if it gets worse to a point in which they can't do some of those, like instrumental ADLs, like buttoning their shirt, cooking dinner, right? Writing a letter to their friend or something. Then that's really when we need a call into clinic, and that's where our nurses are amazing at triaging those calls, and then involving the more interdisciplinary team to get the provider involved and talk about treatment modifications or additional supportive care at that point. But a lot of our patients have baseline neuropathy, so I also talk about a change, right? They're like, "Oh yeah, I already have that in my toes. I can't feel them." And you're like, "Okay, well,
Great.
it might get worse."
Yeah.
And so here's how you would kind of approach that at home, and here's when to call. So that's definitely a common scenario. Less so just because we're giving less chemotherapy, but just because of the nature of the patient population.
Yeah, I completely agree. Are you guys doing like structured symptom calls between cycles, or is this kind of more of a nursing driven thing at your institution?
Yeah, it is definitely nursing driven for the most part. Pharmacists are really there to help triage those calls and work with the provider to make recommendations on the supportive care dose modifications. But our nurses are really, unfortunately, we don't have all the time in the day to make proactive calls. So we're just educating the patients up front to call us when. As soon as something happens, really, our nurses are incredible and able to help with that. And that's the same with, the ophthalmology exams, right? It's a lot more of a reactive approach than a proactive approach when it comes to checking in on symptoms, but we do our best to educate patients on when to call up front.
No, I feel like we do the same thing where we're, heavily involved in those pre-treatment discussions going in when the patient presents and we're talking about treatment. But the capacity to call them after is, a little bit more difficult. But I think always a resource when they do call in and the nurse says, "Hey, they're calling in with this symptom. What do you think, Kristen?" So I feel like I am involved in those discussions and, pinging our nurse practitioners or our, providers saying, "I think we need to, escalate to XYZ." So I feel like that's how we're involved too. Are there any kind of side effects or things that you can think of that require, same day escalation, whether it's like, hey, the patient called in with this, we need to see them today, scenarios?
Yeah, I think that, our nurses are often taking these calls and they can triage most of it, but a lot of times they're reaching out and saying like, is this normal, or is this seems a little bit, out of the what we would normally expect when they're, helping with counseling and things like that. So I'd say, obviously, like very new, extreme, rapidly progressive neuropathy or weakness is something that I would say would be, an immediate referral to like an acute care ED type situation. Certainly, if they've got a rash that looks something like, SJS or 10, then that's going to be an immediate referral. Anything that's blistering involves a mucosa, even if it's widespread and extremely itchy, like we try to get them into derm right away. There is a risk of ILD with enfortumab as well. So any trouble breathing, I would say, an immediate referral to the ED. It's very rare. I think I've only had one patient that we had with ILD, but those are things that we're saying, these are kind of the red flag warnings that you need to be seeing immediately. And I think something that we haven't touched on a lot today is, these patients are also on pembro.
I was just
So,
going to say that too. I'm like, and we can't forget about the
yes.
immunotherapy
So there's of
too. So, read
course
my
a whole
mind.
other discussion with that, right?
Yeah.
That all of our IRAE side effects that we know are more emergent as well, and urgent for seeking care. I think that's why education is such a huge piece of this therapy, and we've got different side effects and overlapping side effects, and it's crucial to have that open communication with the patient about how they're doing. I'm interested too, Kristen, if you have a more structured glucose monitoring protocol, or at what point do you guys engage with endocrinology in patients that may have this hyperglycemia from enfortumab vedotin?
Yeah, so part of our cycle one, day one labs that we'll obtain for patients includes an A1C, which I feel like can be really telling because for some of our patients, we do know that they have a history of type 2 diabetes, but for others, sometimes it does come back as a bit of a surprise or an unknown variable that we weren't aware of before. So we do have that kind of built into the plan. Obviously, with patients with an elevated A1C, if they're not on appropriate blood glucose management, I feel like the one thing that we are doing is we're not necessarily owning that particular piece. We are referring to endocrinology or, if they have a very involved primary care provider that we can refer them back to. But we are making sure that that is under control. We do have, a treatment parameter in our treatment plan where if their blood glucose is above 250, the ner treating nurse needs to page the provider to see if there is any additional supportive care that we need to do. Do they need insulin up an infusion? What else can we optimize? Do we need to reach out to endo, quickly to get their input on how to optimize patients? I feel like in patients that are already on some of our, oral agents for type 2 diabetes or even insulin, especially the insulin, I feel like I'm involved in some of those discussions where how to, should we increase the dose of their long acting? Do we need to increase the dose of their short acting around meals and stuff like that? So I feel like the hyperglycemia is something that we know is associated with enfortumab. Luckily, I feel like our ability to point our finger specifically at enfortumab as the culprit of the elevated blood glucose, I feel like we don't see that all that often. But I think we are just kind of managing patients with hyperglycemia, just given the nature of treating patients with, other comorbidities.
Yeah, I would agree with that approach too, where we're trying to manage it on our own and get a good control of their blood glucose before we initiate therapy, as well as during therapy. But we'll certainly refer, to the experts if somebody's having, treatment delays or a very complex diabetes history. We could definitely reach out to our endocrinology colleagues. Okay, so let's switch gears a little bit into maybe these patients who are struggling with these side effects, or particularly in the muscle invasive space, where we are having patients with delays or discontinuations. How do you deal with this adherence drop off with enfortumab vedotin, and at what point in the treatment course does it need to be addressed?
Yeah, no, I feel like so I can kind of break this up into like the muscle invasive setting and then the metastatic setting, but I feel like in the muscle invasive setting, we know that there's a defined course of treatment that they're going to get, X number of cycles before surgery, X number of cycles after surgery. So I think our providers aren't strict with maintaining patients. Certainly if they need a dose of reduction or, a treatment hold, we will entertain that. But I feel like in the patients where we are trying to go for a cure, our goal is to kind of keep them on track. And so kind of where I come into play is, do we need to look at, a dose reduction for these patients? Is there additional supportive care that we could prescribe to maybe make treatment more tolerable? I think in the metastatic setting is where we kind of see, not providers becoming a little bit more lenient with treatment, but I think there are certain points where certain providers are looking to get X number of cycles in for a patient, or they want to see X number of stable scans before they will consider maybe holding enfortumab. I've seen some hold enfortumab and continue pembrolizumab. We've had some providers hold both drugs. I feel like something that has come into play more, I don't know if you're seeing it at your institution, but we have seen circulating tumor DNA as part of the tool in our toolbox to help kind of guide some of these treatment decisions. So does our values that we're seeing for ctDNA give us, encouraging hope that maybe we have the disease at a good point where we can look at a treatment break. So I feel like all of this kind of comes into play when we're looking at treatment breaks versus treatment discontinuations. And then I think kind of in the metastatic setting, we also have to think our goal is to maintain, prolong life, but also maintain quality of life. So if we're, working to get more and more cycles in these patients, but we're not maintaining their quality of life, then we're really not doing a good job. So I do think that we can definitely like explore treatment breaks in this space as well.
I'd absolutely agree with that kind of more palliative setting where, we want to be meeting patients where they're at, involving them, in all those treatment decisions where ultimately it is up to them whether they want to continue on with aggressive dosing. I've got patients that have extremely debilitating neuropathy, but they're very nervous about dose reductions or delays. And so it's all part of just bringing that patient into those active roles within that discussion and kind of just educating them on what is the goal of this therapy, right? Because we talk like that where it's like palliation and quality of life and overall survival and all these things, but patients don't always know those terms. And it's, I think, our job to help kind of set the tone there and really support them through it, where if we are, wanting to be more aggressive, then we increase our supportive care. But it's a very fine balance, I think. And I think adherence is maybe not even quite the right word because we're seeing that the regimens, especially in the palliative setting, are looking very different depending on the provider and the patient, right? Do they get day one? Do they get day eight? Do they get day 15? Do they get only 1 and 8 or only 1 and 15, right? We're kind of just playing with the dosing to see how long, these patients can stay on active therapy to control their disease.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Especially when we, like you said, we're seeing just single agent enfortumab getting very creative with the dosing schedule just to, make things more tolerable for the patients.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that kind of ties into the next topic, which I can tell we're both very passionate about, but I'd love to know, what high quality patient education looks like from your standpoint when a patient is starting enfortumab and pembro, and what are some of the non-negotiables that you're always covering with your patients that you find are the most important or impactful?
Yeah, so with my patients receiving pembro and enfortumab, I feel like when I initially kind of go in to counsel patient them, they've already seen the nurse, they've already seen the provider, they're kind of overwhelmed with, where they're at, what the treatment regimen is going to be. So we provide them with a calendar to kind of help visualize this is what a treatment cycle looks like. This is day one, and you're going to get both drugs on the first day of treatment. All of these day two, three, four, five, six are your off days, and then you're going to come back a week later and get another, just one drug, the enfortumab. So I feel like once they can kind of visualize what treatment's going to look like, I feel like that is really helpful for kind of just giving them a better idea of this, planning in their calendar what treatment is going to look like for them. We also provide like the infusion durations. So how long should they expect to be in infusion? And I kind of let them know with the caveat too, they're not just going to have an infusion appointment. A lot of times they're going to see the provider, have a lab appointment. So even though it says, it's 2 30-minute infusions, they kind of need to look at, blocking their day a little bit longer just because we know that clinic gets delayed, lab gets backed up, things like that. So what looks like it's going to be a very quick regimen might not actually be as fast as, at least in the beginning, as they might think. So I kind of like to set the stage for kind of what their treatment's going to look like. And then obviously we're going to dive into some of the side effects. I think if I had to pull out a few of my top side effects for patients that I'm going to always counsel on, no matter what, I'm going to mention the rash or itchy skin, especially because that's one of the first things if they were to experience. It's going to be, even with the first or second dose. So telling them kind of what the rash looks like, when to call into clinic. I feel like I kind of give them different rash presentations as well, just because with enfortumab, sometimes, we can see a standard rash versus sometimes it's more in the creases. So in the armpit, groin area, We have some patients reported as just feeling like a sunburn. So kind of letting them know there it could present differently, and to not just be looking for, an outright rash on like their chest or their back. Another thing that I'm gonna, always counsel on is the neuropathy, just because I feel like we, if they're on treatment long enough, we're probably going to encounter this at some point. So kind of letting them know what neuropathy is, how they can look out for it at home. I am mentioning the ocular toxicity just because that is a supportive care that they can get over the counter, using artificial tears if they're noticing dry eye. I feel like that's just like an easy thing that they could pick up. A lot of times, they don't need it up front, but they might need it, as we get a little bit later into treatment. We don't see a ton of myelosuppression with enfortumab, although I have had patients who do present with neutropenia, anemia, and thrombocytopenia. So I am kind of mentioning that as well, specifically like when to call with a fever. So our fever number still applies. If anything over 100.4, you're giving us a call in clinic and we're going to direct you if you can treat at home or if we need to see you. And then obviously I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, like, I'm also counseling on pembrolizumab as well. So, I feel like by the end of that, counseling session, the patients have a lot of information. It's all written on the piece of paper for them. So I always tell them, like, process, take this paper home, bring it back with you, and write your question as questions come up between now and your next visit, write questions on that piece of paper that way you can make sure that you address them beforehand. Just because I know after a long day as a new patient visit where we're establishing this treatment, they're absorbing some of what I'm saying, but it's not all kind of sticking. So I feel like having those written materials is also really helpful for patients.
Very similar to how I would imagine, my own ideal patient education going for enfortumab and pembro. Are there any resources that you really gravitate towards that you find are helpful for patients, or what does your institution do?
Yeah, so I feel like in terms of resources, I honestly feel like I use the package insert to help kind of guide, obviously, like when I'm building my calendar, like when is treatment given? And then I'm really looking either at the package insert or honestly, a lot of times it's, the primary literature, like the EV-302 trial, like what were our top side effects that we were seeing to help, tease those out and to then put them on paper. So I feel like those are kind of my two big resources in terms of materials. I feel like we can't give anything that's branded out in clinic or anything. So we're always designing our own kind of patient handouts that we're providing. And then I feel like we do have just general overview, like peripheral neuropathy, like our nurses will provide handouts regarding like peripheral neuropathy, diarrhea management at home. And that way the patients have kind of those supportive care handouts as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's kind of how we do it as well. And I just think it's nice to have things written down, and it's nice to have other family members in the room too, because I agree, it's totally just information overload, especially with combination therapy and such unique side effects. So I was just curious.
So I think this brings us to our last section, which is regarding real-world implementation, because I think it's easy for us, to read and appreciate the data from the clinical trials, but how do we actually execute things here in clinic is kind of another story. So I know at our site, we're involved in building the treatment plans, kind of educating our staff, developing patient education materials and things like that. Emma, have you noticed any kind of challenges with implementing pembrolizumab and enfortumab at your site?
Yeah, I think that we are involved in a lot of the same kind of workflows and processes as sounds like you are as well. But certainly being in a large institution, there's a lot of other tasks that need to be prioritized. So, the IT's bandwidth has been sometimes a challenge of keeping up with the treatment plan requests, right? Even just changing it from the metastatic setting, which is a different dosing schedule, to the, muscle invasive setting. Those are two different treatment plans that we use. So sometimes IT's at capacity, formulary process takes a long time, even at a large institution. So I'd say, overall, newer therapies are going to take time to onboard, and I can imagine and appreciate that it's even more challenging at a smaller center. So definitely it takes a village to get these therapies up and running, from infusion and nursing and IT and pharmacy and education things. So I think that that is just part of the process. And then, of course, we've got insurance is a whole other ball game, right? Where a lot of times, they'll lag behind guideline recommendations or new data coming out with FDA approvals. So I think that that definitely can play a role too, with just how quickly things are moving in this space.
Yeah, no, I feel like once, we get an FDA approval, I feel like people think treatment can start tomorrow. And I feel like I've learned, over the years that no, there's a stepwise approach to bringing things to formulary, building up treatment plan and things like that, that even with an FDA approval, it could be a couple, weeks to months before things actually get implemented and become kind of our new standard of care in clinic. So I can definitely appreciate some of those implementation challenges as well. I feel like as the bladder cancer landscape continues to evolve, we're seeing new antibody drug conjugates, things that were previously approved, in the second line and beyond setting, getting moved up in the treatment algorithm. So how do you think as pharmacists we can kind of stay on top of things and kind of prepare for what's coming next?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question that I think, pharmacists overall in the oncology space do a really good job of, because we have to stay abreast of all of this new data all the time. So just continue to familiarize yourself with the new drugs, the mechanism of action, the toxicity, the supportive care that comes along with that. Regularly check on the guidelines, because I feel like every time I look at NCCN, it looks different, and it's hard to keep up. So comparing and contrasting, whether it's ASCO or NCCN, all great resources. There's tons of, podcasts out there to stay abreast of the data, follow the big meetings that happen every year, right, with the new data. Our physicians are so sweet, and they sometimes do like a little ASCO or ESMO review just to tell us about some of the new data. But we're already just so embedded in learning new things constantly. I think that this is going to be just part of the norm going forward.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I feel like every time our providers come back from, a conference, they've got big new data that they're excited to talk to us about. And I feel like now, specifically with like the clinical trials that we even have at our institution, kind of getting more involved in those because it's really exciting to see when a drug goes from, just having certain letters and numbers to now having like a brand name and we're actually, using it in treatment is really exciting too. So I feel like, we're not going to get away from antibody drug conjugates by any means in the near future. So I think learning about them, becoming more comfortable with them is really important. And I feel like this kind of brings us to our last kind of question for this MedCast, which is, what is one thing you want every pharmacist who hears this discussion to kind of walk away with or maybe do differently for their bladder cancer patients starting tomorrow?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I'd also love to hear your response too on this. But I think, pharmacists play a very unique role in advocating for our patients and educating our patients. So, these are not the most healthy patients that we're treating with enfortumab and pembro and beyond, right? But advocating for a better quality of life and the best treatment options for them is super important. And I think we play a critical role in the interdisciplinary team in that sense. And then I think patient education is just huge, especially with these, very unique toxicities. The supportive care, like you mentioned before, is just of utmost importance here. And so I think that that's really where, pharmacists really need to focus in on that education piece, both to staff as newer therapies come out, but also to patients, to make sure that they understand the expectations of their treatments.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I feel like I love the patient education piece, but I also love the ed educating our staff as well. Like, hey, this is, the drugs that you're going to need to, like, we counsel most patients, but if I'm not around, you need to know kind of the big pearls and things to expect with treatment too. I feel like my kind of pearl or piece of advice for pharmacists going away from, like, walking away from this MedCast is just kind of to become more comfortable with enfortumab and pembrolizumab, specifically managing their toxicities. I think as an oncology pharmacist, we're really comfortable with managing toxicities related to traditional chemo. We know patients are going to nadir around day 7 or 10 after they get their gemcitabine and cisplatin treatment. They m are probably going to experience nausea and vomiting. Whereas I feel like with enfortumab and pembrolizumab, we do have known side effects, but sometimes the predictability or the onset of when these side effects happen is different patient to patient. And so getting kind of comfortable working in this gray zone of teasing out, do we think it's from the enfortumab? Do we think it's from the pembrolizumab? Is something that I think makes our job exciting because, a lot of times there's really not a right answer for a lot of things. It's kind of just using your clinical judgment, patient-specific factors to kind of come up with what you think the best treatment plan or best approach to a toxicity is for a patient. So I feel like the role of the oncology pharmacist is always expanding. And pembrolizumab and enfortumab is just kind of another treatment regimen for us to become, more involved in patient care. And I think this kind of concludes our MedCast. So Emma, it was a pleasure getting to talk to you about pembrolizumab and enfortumab and bladder cancer. And I'm kind of excited to see the future directions and, in a MedCast 6 months from now, kind of where we're at in treatment as well.